I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the strange one-way intimacy between homeowners and housekeepers. We'll spend this hour with Stephanie Land, who supported herself and her infant daughter scrubbing toilets, floors, and sinks for clients who often preferred never to see her at all, as if a ghost had showed up to tidy their homes. That distance may have made it easier for Land's clients to overlook the fact that she was overworked and underpaid, kept afloat for a time by seven different forms of government assistance, despite always having a job. Land, on the other hand, knew a great deal about those clients, how they lived, what they spent their money on, when they were sick or healthy, even what kind of relationships they had. Our conversation starts after a short break. If you pay somebody to clean your house, you can arrange to see that person for a few minutes each time, or pretty much never. You can leave a key and a check and come home to sparkling floors and tidy rooms. It can seem like it all happened by magic, but there is a real human being taking care of your house for you, and no matter what you're paying for the service, you should know she might barely be scraping by. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Stephanie Land cleaned houses as a suddenly single mother of an infant daughter. Her then-partner had grown abusive, and without family who could float her any money or let her stay for long, she ended up first in housing for the homeless, then some pretty dicey low-rent places. She was working the entire time, picking up landscaping and stable hand hours between cleaning gigs. But it wasn't enough for her and her daughter to survive by itself. It took government assistance for food, rent, tuition, and health care to make it possible for this working parent to begin the slow and unsteady climb out of poverty. Stephanie Land did finally complete her education. She makes her living as a writer now. Her new memoir is called Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So you were raised middle class, spent your early 20s like a lot of people, working in restaurants and kind of side hustle types of gigs. You were about ready to start college at 28 and found out you were pregnant.
That's correct. I decided to go to the University of Montana after seeing one of my favorite writers give a talk, and he's admitted to living in the area and sometimes teaching at the college. So I had actually filled out applications and then threw them in the garbage when I found out I was pregnant.
How did thinking about your mother shape your decision to keep your baby?
My mother actually had told me that since she was only 19 when she found out she was pregnant with me, that she heavily debated abortion and actually sat in the parking lot but just decided to not go through with it. And that shaped me a lot since I learned that when I was, you know, a teenager. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I was trying to make that decision, I remembered that conversation with her and what a decision it was.
It was a momentous decision to realize you had to be fully on your own when your daughter was a tiny baby. It wasn't safe for you with your boyfriend at the time.
No, it was. He was incredibly emotionally abusive, and then he did something. He punched out a window and a door of the place that we were living in, and that. At the moment, all I saw that was as physical evidence or, you know, like real evidence that he was being abusive to me. Mm-hmm. Emotional abuse is so invisible and a lot of people don't really see it as abuse. But at that point, I was incredibly depressed and, you know, had absolutely no money. He wouldn't let me work and was kind of trapped in this house with an infant day after day.
So you went to some transitional housing. You had to follow the rules in order just to keep a roof over your baby's head, and you were willing to do that. But it seems like whoever wrote those rules wrote them to humiliate someone who happened to need help.
Yeah, not necessarily. I don't think they purposefully wrote them to humiliate. I mean, I would hope not. But I think it's it could have been things that had happened in the past that they had to adhere some new rules to prevent that from happening again. But there were four pages of rules and regulations that went anywhere from that I would have checks, you know, to make sure that I was keeping up on house cleaning and or that I would do urinalysis tests to make sure I wasn't drinking or doing any drugs. And it just kind of went on and on and on from there.
Hmm. So you started learning this like complicated alphabet of federal programs and state programs and local programs, CHIP and SNAP and WIC and LIHEAP and EBT and TEBRA and TANF and Section 8. They all came with a lot of requirements too. Can you talk about what you had to do to prove that you were poor?
Wow. Well, I mean, when you don't have any money, you have to be able to prove that you don't. And so, you know, you show them what kind of car you have. You'd show them your bank accounts. You'd prove that you're not working, or that you prove that you're working very little or whenever you do. And if you're working the types of jobs that I was in the very beginning, it was, you know, gig jobs, landscaping jobs. Sometimes friends would hire me to clean their house when you know, they couldn't necessarily afford it, but they knew that I really needed the money. And so I ended up carrying around this folder of all of this proof, because it always seemed like I was having to prove myself not only in need, but in that I was working.
So childcare is, I was a single parent for a while when my kids were very small, and I had a middle class income, and they received Social Security, and childcare costs were the thing that kept me up at night. So I can't imagine trying to find decent care when you don't have a lot of options financially.
Yeah. So how that kind of started, both times that I had to apply for childcare, back in the beginning when Mia was really young, a single mom and I traded off our kids. So she worked in the morning and I worked in the afternoon. And after a few weeks, I had enough of a regular schedule and enough proof that I was working in order to apply for and obtain a childcare grant. Because in order to get the grant, you need to prove that you're working, which is kind of difficult when you need childcare to work.
Right.
And so once I got the childcare grant, then Mia was able to go to daycare in the afternoons from like 12:30 to 4:30 or something like that. I was granted a small amount of childcare. So we still traded off in the helped each other with childcare sometimes, but most of the time I just worked in the afternoon.
That's still a lot of like responsibility at all times. You didn't get a lot of breaks.
No, there's no breaks. Yeah. I mean, I still feel like I don't have any breaks, you know, between the work that I do, and then there's the invisible work of mm-hmm. of cleaning the house and cooking and grocery shopping. And they call it the mental load of scheduling appointments and making sure that everybody has socks and everything you can imagine.
I was really struck by the isolation that you felt. You write about the fact that when you were in this moment where you were, you know, raising your daughter by yourself, you were kind of plunged into poverty, you drifted away from your friends because I guess they couldn't relate to what you were going through. And sometimes they said just horrible things to you without realizing how horrible they were.
Yeah, I had a friend tell me, she said, "You're welcome," after I told her all of the government assistance programs that I was on. And I was a little shocked and said, "You know, what do you mean by that?" And she said, "Well, my tax dollars are paying for that, so you're welcome." And I've since talked to her, and she's, you know, well, I told her that that conversation was in the book, to be quite honest. And she said, "Yeah, I can imagine it would have been." And I had to explain that was a very defining moment for me. Like, I started hiding my situation from people. Mm-hmm. I've had friends from Port Townsend reach out to me who have read the book and have said, like, "I had absolutely no idea that you were struggling so hard. Like, I would have offered to babysit. I would have, you know, I would have given you a free haircut. All of these things," but they had no idea. And for me, I thought there was like a flashing neon banner over my head all the time.
So you weren't trying to hide it.
I wasn't. I mean, I didn't go around talking about how much I got in food stamps or anything. But, you know, it's a visible thing to pay with an EBT card. Mm-hmm. And it's a visible thing to have a baby and this custody battle. And it's a very, very small town of Port Townsend. So I guess I just felt like everybody knew what was going on.
It sounds like shopping for food could be just a real, I mean, it's already a pain to go to the grocery store, but it was a hassle every time.
Yeah, I think back to that time a lot, actually, because I'm so far removed from adding up the price and, you know, doing a lot of subtracting and adding and math while I'm shopping.
Yeah.
Because I only had, you know, a couple hundred bucks a month for my entire food budget. And so I knew exactly what I needed and how much it would cost and how much I had available, how much I had available in my account if I needed a sponge or, you know, toothpaste. And sometimes I couldn't buy those things because I didn't have the money for them. And with the food, I just remember this like kind of clenching and clawing feeling in my stomach, watching them add up the food items that were on the conveyor belt and not wanting to go over. And then like planning, okay, so if it goes over, then I can turn back the, or I can, you know, tell them to give back the bread or the peanut butter or, you know, the most expensive item on there.
And your daughter would come home from seeing her dad and say, we were able to eat as many berries as we wanted. And this just like was a gut punch for you.
Yeah, I felt like that I was failing as a parent constantly. I mean, especially cleaning and working in the houses that I did and seeing these bedrooms for kids that were as big as the studio apartment we lived in. And they had bunk beds and trampolines in the backyard and dogs and, you know, huge TVs and all of these things. And I felt like I was constantly seeing the life that my daughter should be having.
Mm-hmm.
I tried to make the best of what we did, you know, that we often had to find free activities to do. But I tried to be as focused on her as I possibly could be when we were together. We just weren't together very often.
Yeah. So let's talk about the people you cleaned for. Some of them kept you invisible in their lives.
Yeah. Some of them I never saw. And it's hard to have a relationship with them. And so I kind of started to have a relationship with their house or the little things that they left behind that would allow me to get to know them. Because if you start paying attention and just look at the random things that you leave around in your house, you know, a certain coffee mug or a pen or a chair where you obviously sit and watch TV, you leave a lot of clues that people will kind of get a, I don't know, they'll kind of get to know you through that.
Were you ever so curious that you went looking in places that people might not have expected you to look?
I mean, I don't think there was anything too extreme other than, you know, opening up a medicine cabinet and looking in there. I mean, I'll admit I've done that in my friends' houses, but I didn't do any like investigative snooping through. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think people think snooping and they think like, oh my God, were you going through their bedroom drawers or anything? And it was nothing like that. It was just, just very quick glances and not digging.
It sounds like often you got an emotional sense of how these people were doing. Like they might have tons more money than you, but they weren't necessarily in a good place.
Yeah, it seemed like they worked really hard to maintain a house that they didn't really get to enjoy or that they didn't use very much. And a lot of time that didn't make sense to me. It seemed like they were gone a lot and they were sick a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And going into this, like I kind of believed that rich people didn't get the common cold or, you know, because they have access to healthcare and yoga and kale and, you know, like all of these things that are supposed to keep you healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I just kind of assumed that the common cold wouldn't touch them. And so I was even more shocked to see that they struggled with chronic pain or, ongoing sinus problems or, you know, just things that you normally wouldn't think of with someone with a lot of access to healthcare.
My guest is writer Stephanie Land. We're talking about her memoir, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. If you'd like to join us, you can call 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter at @KERAThink. Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with writer Stephanie Land about her memoir, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So you wanted as much work as you could get. The agency that you worked for initially, they limited your hours because they knew that anybody who worked 40 hours a week cleaning houses would get hurt or exhausted so quickly that it wouldn't be worth it to them to hire you.
Well, not that it, they were worried that I might get hurt or injure myself on the job. Mm-hmm. And so they said anything over 6 hours a day, I run the risk of injury.
That tells you something about the work they're asking you to do.
Yeah. And especially I had a, well, I still have it, a spine condition called scoliosis, where your spine curves a whole bunch. And it had actually pinched the nerve in my right arm, so that a lot of the times when I was cleaning, I had to kind of ball up my hand into a fist and punch the sponge into the tub and scrub it like that. And by the end of the day, I couldn't even carry groceries inside the house with that arm.
So I get the sense reading the book that you actually took a lot of pride in doing a good job. And I wonder if you ever asked yourself, why can't I just give this 50% and just get it done and leave? Like, did you struggle with the fact that you cared very much about giving people what they paid for?
Well, you want more work. And so you only get more work by doing a good job. Mm-hmm. And so there was that aspect of it. But there was also a kind of satisfying part to the job. Like, it had a beginning, middle, and end, and you see immediate results, very different from the rest of my life, where I just felt like it was this never-ending chaos or, you know, this relentless thing that I had to do in order to survive. But, like, the cleaning jobs, those were a little bit better because I felt like I was finishing something.
You had this mantra, which is, I cannot let myself fall apart. Why were you so afraid of crying even once?
It felt like I was losing control, I think. It felt like that life was kind of getting to me so much that I could no longer keep myself together. I felt like the only thing that I could really do was control how I reacted to the situation. And crying also just, you feel so helpless and so vulnerable. And I didn't have anyone to rush in and comfort me, which just kind of perpetuates the loneliness. And it was never something that I really liked doing. I felt like if I cried every single time things got hard, then I would just be crying all the time. And so I tried so hard to not, I don't know, just not do it, I guess.
So you were relatively young in your 20s when you were dealing with all this. Some people might be saying, well, where were your parents? Your dad had some financial problems and he was really stressed. There's a story that you tell, and I almost hate to make you retell it, about your mother and her boyfriend coming and making you pay for your own lunch.
Yeah. Under normal circumstances, it would have been normal and acceptable and expected for me to buy them lunch that day because they had just spent a few hours helping me move. And it was a job, you know, it was hard work. There were stairs involved. I had some furniture, but they had just helped me move out of a homeless shelter. And so we all went out to lunch. And when it came time for me to go, because I had to go to another job, a cleaning job, and my mom's husband in particular expected me to pick up the check. And I had to look at them both and admit, like, I only have $10 in my bank account. And he just kind of, I don't know. I just remember this like feeling of like expecting smoke to come out of his nostrils or something. He was so angry and said like, well, that barely even pays for your burger. And I just remember sitting there like feeling so helpless and not knowing
right,
what to do.
Right, that barely pays for my burger.
Yeah. And so my mom offered, well, then just pay for the $10. And I did. And it left me with 30 cents in my bank account and had no idea when I was going to get paid again. And I still to this day don't know how that happened. you know, you think about your parents and your mother especially, and you would think that in that situation, she would kind of want to take care of you or stand up for you or have your back a little bit. And she absolutely didn't. And that was one of the many things that kind of marked our relationship to the point of us no longer talking.
So it's a different situation, certainly, with your mother. But that story makes me realize that we, in our culture, in our effort to encourage people to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps, we basically tell poor people that they have no right to complain about anything under any circumstances, no matter what's happening.
Yes, because there is always someone who has it worse, because there are, you know, starving children. I even felt that. I felt like I never went to the food bank because I thought that that was reserved for people who were truly, truly hungry. And I had peanut butter and bread in the cupboard, so I wasn't truly hungry. But we're also told a myth in this country. We're told that if we work hard enough that we'll make it. But that is not the case anymore because we don't have healthcare systems. We don't have a living wage that we pay people. And a lot of people are born with privileges that others don't have. And so when you group us all into this same category of work will get you what you want and make you succeed, that's just not true. When other people are being paid a lot more, they're walking into positions because of connections, they have the education, you know, that you can go on and on and on. But to look at poor people and say, you're just not working hard enough, the fact is they're probably working twice as hard.
I also felt for you in the situation where your daughter was getting sick a lot because you lived in this house that had black mold and there wasn't much you could do about it. And you would try to clean it away and it just wouldn't go anywhere. And so you were at the doctor and the nurse said to you, you got to do better than this. And I mean, you were doing everything you could. And I wonder about the combination. I think I would feel a combination of deep anger at her and also deep shame that somehow she had judged me.
Yeah, I was already feeling judged because she asked what my living conditions were like instead of, you know, where do you live? Mm-hmm. Do you live in a house or an apartment? But it was living conditions. And so that's usually reserved for people who have conditions that they're living mm-hmm. in instead mm-hmm. of a home or a house or, you know, something that's socially acceptable. And I had brought Mia to the doctor a lot that year. And I think I don't know where she was coming from with that, but in telling me I had to do better because I had already explained to her that my landlord, you know, wasn't helping me with a black mold situation and probably wouldn't. You know, I tried to keep it as clean as I could. And I didn't know how to do better other than finding us a new place to live. And I was barely affording a studio apartment at $550 a month rent. And as a mother, that was just kind of like, you know, a searing spike in the heart. Like, you know, you want to do right by your kids and you want to give them a healthy environment and you want to give them the life that you would want for them. And I wasn't doing that. And it was obvious to other people around me. And that, I don't know, that just showed me how obvious it was.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Diane in San Antonio. Hi, Diane.
Hi. Excuse my crackly voice.
It's okay.
I just wanted to thank you so much for bringing some light to a very interesting topic. Cleaning houses saved me from poverty. I couldn't find a job, even though I had secretarial skills, et cetera. And I lived in Houston at the time. One day, out of frustration, I just went to bed. I was so anxious and upset. I laid my head down, and I thought, what am I good at? And all of a sudden, it was ding, ding, ding. You clean houses great. You keep your house great. Perfectly Made was born that day. I had a week's worth of clients the next week. Some of them were not very nice. Like when I did a spring cleaning, some people would unload their kitchen cabinets and I'd have to clean all their dishes. Hmm. I didn't like that. I thought, you know, I undercharged you. But they were also surprised to see a white girl. A lot of them were really surprised to see a white girl, which I thought, well, why? But thank you for putting some really nice light on this, because we learn about people in that industry a lot and quickly. Some people are wonderful and some people are little devils.
Well, Diane, thanks for your call. It sounds like things worked out for you in the end. Did people comment on your race? Were they surprised to see a white woman cleaning their houses?
No, I honestly lived in a pretty white area. There was a strong migrant population, but I didn't see any. Well, I didn't have any coworkers, and the other workers at the cleaning company I lived in, it was kind of outside of where the migrant population was. So I think we were all white who worked there.
You did have a couple of clients who just, it wasn't that they did anything so amazing, but they just treated you like a fellow human being. And I love the story of the guy who would talk to you like a person who was performing the service for him and was buying lobsters for a weekend party. And he said, why don't I pick you guys up a couple? And what I love about the story is, on the one hand, like, expensive seafood might have been the very last thing you needed. And yet he wasn't buying it because you needed it. He just was doing a nice thing for a person he liked.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. Henry himself was really amazing. And his house was one of the harder ones. I often sweated because I only had 4 hours to clean this huge house with tile floors. And he had like two dogs. And so there was a lot. But I think he recognized that, maybe, or that he just saw, I don't know what he saw in me, but he saw that I was a really hard worker. And those lobsters were incredible. I mean, you know, you have all of this legislation coming out that are trying to prohibit people from buying lobsters on food stamps because they're like such a fancy thing. And I certainly never bought them on food stamps, but it was a food that I could never afford. And it was pretty great for dinner that night.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Henry also talked to you about traveling.
He did. I mentioned to him that I had wanted to move to Missoula, Montana, and he had traveled up there pretty frequently to go to Glacier National Park, which is up by the Canadian border. I forget that I'm in Texas, and I should probably explain.
Thank you for
that.
The context. Yeah.
and so he handed me all these maps and brochures, and he's like, "Oh, you've got to go. You absolutely need to go. It's beautiful over there."
And part of you wanted him to understand. Well, you didn't. I guess you didn't want him to understand, but you were thinking, I can't afford to go there.
Well, and not necessarily that I couldn't afford it. I couldn't hope for something that good, and because allowing me to hope for something really good and not being able to do it, like, made it worse that I couldn't do stuff. So I tried to limit my dreaming and like limit. Anything like that, because I just felt like I was going to have this like crushing disappointment.
I want to talk about the earned income tax credit, because this is, we're very anti-welfare in this country. And so the EITC, you know, a lot of people say it's kind of this socially acceptable form of aid, cash aid to families who are working and raising families, but not on a sort of traditional welfare program. This windfall allowed you to gain some stability that no amount of sort of saving $5 out of every paycheck would have allowed you.
Yeah, it not only allowed me to gain stability, or, you know, not worry about finances, not do that constant math, mm-hmm. for a few months, but it allowed me to buy vitamins and, you know, go and get all of those toiletries that normally I was so stressed about. I think, you know, we got new toothbrushes. We went out to dinner. I went on a grocery shopping trip where I bought avocados, which is like something I never could have afforded. I bought curtains for our windows. Our studio had like 9 windows in it, and it was either very hot or very cold. And so I bought actual curtains instead of hanging sheets over the windows, and bought, you know, a heated mattress pad so I didn't have to heat the whole room and we would still be warm at night in bed, because otherwise we had to sleep kind of huddled on the fold-out couch together for warmth in the wintertime. And there were a lot of things that I purchased with that, which some might call irresponsible decisions, because I was like blowing all this money, but really, like, I was upgrading our living space to something that was tolerable and livable, or at least a little bit more comfortable.
You didn't get paid for travel time.
No, I didn't. And I've heard arguments from people like, well, I don't get paid to commute either. But for me, it was once I was at work and, you know, technically on the clock, even though I was clocking in and clocking out of a job, I had to drive to the next job. That was all on the same day with the same company. And it was often, you know, a half an hour, 45 minutes. And when you're getting paid minimum wage and then you have gas to count, and then I had to wash my own work rags, and so I had to go to the laundromat once a week. And so when you take into account like all of that, then I figured out one day that I was only making $5 or $6 an hour. And so driving to a house for, you know, 45 minutes, I would count up like how much that 45 minutes had already cost me and how much I would have to work off just to pay for the gas. And it just, it makes a degrading job just feel even more miserable when so much of the hourly wage is taken up by just the ability to drive yourself there.
How old is Mia now?
She's 11 and a half.
Does she remember being poor?
No, I don't think so. She was pretty little, and her life wasn't too much different. I mean, she had less. I mean, I can see the difference now. But to her, you know, it was the same type of life. The surroundings were just different.
My guest is writer Stephanie Land. We're talking about her memoir, Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes and take some more of your calls. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find us on Twitter. We're @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with writer Stephanie Land about her book Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. You can join us at 800-933-5372. We have Bruce on the line in Houston. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Stephanie, thank you for sharing your story. I came into the broadcast a little bit ago, and I heard you talking about how the company you were working for, and I didn't catch whether it was a company or a referral service or whatever, how they didn't want you to work more than 40 hours a week because the work was too strenuous and you might get hurt. And my immediate reaction was, wait a minute, that sounds like a company that doesn't want to have full-time employees that they have to pay benefits to under what many companies call the McDonald's rule, to where if a worker works 39 hours a week or less, they are considered part-time and do not have to be paid benefits. Any comments you have on that? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for calling.
I think it's pretty notorious in that profession to not get any benefits. And I think that's what Kamala Harris is trying to do right now with the Domestic Workers Bill of Rights. And there have been a lot of movements to unionize within hotel maids, especially not only for safety concerns, but to get benefits like sick pay and vacation days and health insurance. I did not get any of those. I didn't even get sick pay. You know, it was a very minimally paid job.
How much did the stigma of poverty and of receiving benefits, even though you knew you were working as hard as you could and doing the best you could, how much did that shape the way you saw yourself?
Well, I keep saying the word failure and or just that I was never doing enough. I felt like I wasn't enough. I felt like there was no way that I could do what I needed to do in order to, in my mind, make people happy, you know, because you saw all of these memes on Facebook and you saw all these comments about people on welfare and how they needed to do drug tests. And, you know, there was this saying, don't feed the animals. And that became associated with people on food stamps because you didn't want them to become dependent on handouts and not know how to survive on their own. Very much treated like an uneducated, unintelligent, you know, just or a group that was choosing that life because for some reason people thought that, you know, we were still sitting on the couch eating bonbons all day and just like raking in all of this government money when really, you know, it's a little bit over a dollar a meal per person if you're on food stamps.
So what was the calculation you made about trying to go back to or go to college? Because I'm sure that that changed a lot of things with regard to your ability to work and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that came out of I was landscaping and, you know, was making pretty good money or pretty good wages in the small amount of time that I was able to work, but the very seasonal position. And I had already been applying for jobs, and this was in the height of the recession. And I was losing out on positions because they were 9-to-5 daytime positions. And a lot of those had been taken up, you know, entry-level positions had been taken up by people with degrees who had been laid off. I had absolutely no professional experience. You know, I had been like a coffee shop girl. I'd worked at a Montessori school. I'd like done all these weird kind of jobs throughout my 20s. But I never had problems finding a job until I had to admit that I needed to work during daycare hours. And as soon as someone knew that I had a limit on what hours I could work and that I had a kid at home, I was pretty much shown the door immediately.
Even though that's illegal.
It was, but like they didn't say that directly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just saw it in their face and, you know, I just knew and I didn't get a call back. I must have applied for, you know, 3 or 4 jobs a week for a good year and a half.
All right. I want to go back to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Meredith on the line in Austin. Hi, Meredith.
Hi. I really appreciate this conversation. I was service industry for 10 years plus myself and am fascinated by service industry conversations. And I wanted to ask, what's the strangest thing you ever found in someone's house, either literally or figuratively?
Well, there's a house in the book called The Porn House, and it got that name because sometimes when I showed up to clean, there was a bottle of lubricant on the nightstand. And, you know, I'm not going to be judgmental against that, but I was appalled that I was suddenly included in this person's intimate life without my consent, you know? And so that would probably be the strangest thing. And I can't think of any others that really stick out or come to mind. I think the one of the greatest things in all of the houses was I had a house that I called the beach house, which was not in the book, but I absolutely loved being in this house. They had like blue tile everywhere. It was like my like dream house. But they also had like the fattest pug. That was like this little dog that sat upright on the couch, just kind of like scratching his belly. And so just even little things like that would, you know, make my day and have like be like a bright, sunny place in my normal job.
You write that the job of a maid is essentially to touch every surface throughout a given house. I mean, there's no way that you can do that without sort of learning about people. I wonder if you, you know, you talked about the things in the kids' rooms that you would realize your daughter didn't have at that point. Did you fight envy or like, did you ever feel like what did they do to deserve this?
No, not at all.
You didn't feel that way?
I don't think I ever felt that way at all. I felt more like, these people are my age or just a little bit older, or these people are the same age as my parents. Mm-hmm. Like, how is my life and their life so different? And I think it had just been drilled into me so much that I wasn't making it, and that was my own personal failure.
What was the sad house?
So the sad house was, it was actually next door to the porn house, not related by any means with the names. But so it was a widower, and I called it the sad house because he was obviously deeply mourning his wife still after it seemed like she had died many, many years ago. And yet he was absolutely surrounded by photographs in the house. He even had like her old to-do list still tacked up on the mm-hmm. cork board in the kitchen, and like the paper was yellowed. It just seemed like a shrine for her, and had not changed. Everything got dusty in that house, even the kitchen counters. And it seemed like he slept there and sometimes ate, you know, he would eat like deli food. And then he watched these old VHS tapes on the TV of Christmas and holidays. And it just seemed like he was very ill and didn't have anyone to take care of him. And it seemed like he was just kind of waiting, whatever his beliefs were, to join her or to end a life of being alone.
And you felt kind of protective of him.
I did. I felt for him, and I really liked him. I liked his wife especially. Like, I felt like I got to know her too. It seemed like they had traveled a lot together, especially down to South America and Mexico. And she brought back all these trinkets. She was like a school teacher. It's funny. I can talk about these people like they were my friends,
they have no idea they're in your book, probably.
Probably not. No. And the guy who lived at the sad house, I only like bumped into him once and never really talked to him either. But I feel like I know them just by the things that they had in their house.
All right. Back to the phones. 800-933-5372 is our number. Jason is calling from Austin. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead.
Yeah, I'll be brief. I know you're close to the ending. I was just curious on your take on the restaurant industry as far as their base pay being below, the average wage, you know, $213 is kind of a common, but depending where you're at, and how you interpret that in the expression of livelihood in people who have to rely on tip-based, income to hold the household together. It's a very common thing. Everybody relies on it. Everybody goes out to eat. So I just thought I'd throw that on the table.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I don't know much about that from personal experience, but I do know that that's a thing, and it seems a little unbelievable that that even happens. I didn't know that it was as low as $2. I thought it was somewhere around $4 that wait staff gets paid. I will say, though, that being a person who used to not even be able to afford to go out to eat and then wouldn't go out to eat because I couldn't afford to leave a good tip, like, the greatest part about like book tour and, you know, some recent success that I've had with the book, like, I love over tipping people. last night I got room service after I came in and you know, left a pretty good tip for the guy bringing the food up. And he looked at it and he's like, "This is awesome. You are awesome." And just the surprise that comes across people's faces. Like, I remember feeling that, like, if someone tipped me $10 after cleaning their house, like, that meant that I could get my daughter a happy meal at the time, which was a huge treat for her. And those like momentary just like looks of joy on her face just made everything worth it.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. What is your relationship to money now?
Boy, I don't know. I think, well, I'm still pretty deeply in debt from student loans. Mm-hmm. I still, you know, have to pay off the $50,000 or whatever that I borrowed to get a college education and support myself and my daughter. And I still have, you know, two kids to put through college or at least help put through college. And, you know, I still have an older car and rent and but I also don't trust things like until I actually see it. So, you know, a lot of my friends are celebrating the success, especially, you know, we found out yesterday that it's number 3 on the
congratulations.
Yeah, on the bestseller list, which is just huge and unexpected. And everybody is like, oh, you're going to be rich and famous. And it's like, am I really though? Like, I'm just a writer. And so I tend to try and stay underwhelmed, but I'm also asking for help from, like, I hired a bookkeeper and became officially like a business, and I'm trying to learn how to budget for the future because when you're poor and you're really struggling, I never thought about the future, because who wants to think about your future when your life sucks? And anytime I thought about like where I was going to be or what I was going to be doing 5 or 10 years from now, you know, in the thick of it, all I saw was myself still struggling and still working as a house cleaner and still living in like this like dank place. And so I focused on day-to-day stuff. And especially when you are counting the dollars and counting the hours that you work and doing math and like figuring out if you're going to be able to make it through the month, you know, that extreme amount of budgeting is just, how do you see a bigger picture with that? So I'm trying to learn how to do that. Like, I have no idea what tax laws there are, you know, for 401ks or different savings accounts. And so I've been asking a lot of like financial advisors, like, what should I be doing like to prepare for the future? And so it's a huge learning process.
Do you talk to your kids a lot about money?
Oh boy, I try. I give Mia an allowance, and it's not based on any work that she does around the house. She has chores, and but it's not like if you do all these chores, then you get an allowance.
Because you the chores anyway, right?
Yeah, definitely. But I give her $20, and like I did that before I left for a book tour, and we went out to the mall because I needed some things, and she wanted to spend her entire allowance on a, you know, stuffed animal at this store. And it's like, really? Like, come on. I mean, budget it out, or, you know, like, don't spend it all in one place, please.
Stephanie Land's memoir is called Made: Hard Work, Low Pay, and a Mother's Will to Survive. Stephanie, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to our podcast using whatever podcast app you prefer, and learn about upcoming shows at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.